So we're going to spend a little time looking at wealth a little bit more. Last week we talked about this acquiring wealth, some of the difficulties with it. It comes from our view, all our self-limiting views on what we think about wealth and how we hold it itself, and then a little bit more about basically whatever it is that we're connected to and how we kind of see it. How we, the word here I was going to look for, this having, yeah, faith, that's what it was, having faith in our own potential to be able to, in order to acquire wealth, it has to come from somewhere in here that we have to believe ourselves almost worthy as a way you can save for wealth. And then tonight, we are going to talk about maintaining wealth. And it does not, it strikes me, well, I guess I should say, it doesn't go unnoticed with me that today also happens to be Martin Luther King's birthday. So there's some kind of thing here I can feel, this connection between this maintaining wealth that we have acquired and civil rights. I don't know why the two seem connected to me, but they do. And so a lot of the kind of the poetry and the quotes that I'm going to read from and share with us tonight are kind of taken from that perspective. Because maybe it's because this idea of maintaining wealth coming from a Black person in a country where the divide around wealth is so huge, maybe that's it. Maybe I just have a sense that we're going to have to talk about wealth in a completely different way, that we can't approach it just from how much money you have or how much money you don't have. I think we have to get connected to it in a way that if I were to just be honest, I think sometimes being white, you are more able to disconnect from the idea of wealth. Mostly because the privilege that comes with being white affords a level of compensation that you may not see. You may not, those of you that are white, you may not see that compensation that automatically happens. But a way to begin to see might be if you heard from, I'm just going to use Black people because I'm Black and I just grabbed some quotes from Black people, but if you heard from BIPOC people or people of color who don't have that privilege and we just kind of flip it a little bit, I think you could begin to see a way, a questioning, a looking into, a getting intimate with wealth from a different way. And this is all going to come in relation to maintaining wealth. So I thought I'd start with this quote by Reverend Angel Kiero Williams. I thought this would be a good way to start. Maybe it'll make sense what I'm trying to say here. So in Reverend Angel's quote, she says, what we imagine ourselves to be looking for, what we imagine ourselves to be looking for as Black Americans is not out there. It's in here, in our hearts. What we need in order to be equal as people of color in a country that often divides us on the basis of color, on the basis of the color of our skin, is to be found not in further separation, further division, but in oneness and in intimacy. It is in the separation that our true selves, it is in the separation from our true selves that keeps us from enjoying personal happiness. So I'm reading again. What we imagine ourselves to be looking for as Black Americans is not out there. It's in here, in our hearts. What we need in order to be equal as people of color in a country that often divides us on the basis of color, the color of our skin, is to be found not in further separation, greater division, but in oneness and in intimacy. It is the separation from our true selves that keeps us from enjoying personal happiness. Now, Reverend Angel wrote that. That quote came in relation to her talking to Black Americans. But if you think about it, that quote is not just pointing to Black Americans. It's pointing to anyone. And what it's basically saying is, if we want to come to an understanding around wealth, we can't be looking for our understanding and how to understand wealth out there. We got to look for it in here. And in order for us to come to an understanding around wealth in a country that's very, very divisive and complicated and not even honest about wealth, in order for us to come to a place of honesty and connection around wealth within ourselves, we can't do that by ignoring the truth about our relationship with wealth itself. It's going to come from having a greater oneness and intimacy with our own understanding about our own relationship with our own wealth in here. And it is the separation that we actually have from our true relationship with money or abundance or a sense of abundance or a sense of having, that separation is what keeps us from enjoying happiness. Last week, we were talking about, as lay practitioners, our happiness comes from our relationship with the sense stores and pleasure and sensory type pleasures. And that's going to come from our connection with a sense of wealth, money, possibility, all of that. Not just money, but the things that money help us see. We were talking about it in relation to friendships and other things. It doesn't have to just be around money. But if money is your edge, if you're like, oh no, let's talk about the wealth of friends. Let's don't talk about the wealth of money. That's where you need to go, over there to that money side, because you're totally okay on the friend side. You need to turn over there to the money side. The place where we are having the tension, the division, the difficulty, that's where we need to turn towards to look at it. So what the Buddha said about maintaining the wealth that we actually acquire was a layperson's objective in the English version of it. This would be the layperson's objective. I should live a long and dignified life with my relatives and teachers, with the wealth obtained through righteous means. It's pleasant, agreeable, charming, and only achievable through effort. So this kind of way that the Buddha is acknowledging that we, I don't know how to stress it, but if we don't allow ourselves or give ourselves permission to acquire wealth and to have wealth, to be in abundance and to acquire that abundance in a world where there's so much lacking, then we're going to have, there's a duality here that causes a conflict. And so a way to, I think, to begin to touch into this has to do with the way the Buddha the way he points to actually the acquisition of wealth. He just doesn't seem to have a problem with wealth. We have a problem with wealth. We act like, even as lay practitioners, we shouldn't have that much money. Or if we do have a lot of money, we got to keep that on the down low because we don't want anyone to know that we have a lot of money. I don't know why, but we don't want anyone to know. And there's all this issue around money, abundance. I remember once having a really difficult time with someone who kept referring to their money and their means as being fortunate. Like, I'm fortunate, I'm fortunate, I'm fortunate. That's what they kept saying. I'm fortunate, I'm fortunate, I'm fortunate. Oh, I'm so fortunate to have this, and I was so fortunate to have that. And I said, well, didn't you work? Didn't you earn any of that stuff? Or what, was it just given to you because of who you are? They were like, no, I worked really hard. I'm like, well, didn't you earn that? What's all this fortunate for? Because it sounds like when we keep saying, oh, I'm fortunate because I have that, that we're somehow saying someone else is unfortunate. Like good is coming to us and good is not going to other people. But that isn't truly what's happening. This idea of the unfortunate, as if simply because we have a lot of money, there's some fortune there. But those of us that know people that have a lot of money, we would question whether or not there's a lot of fortune in all that money. But that's another thing. The point that I'm saying is that there's a way in which we make excuses for having wealth in a world where there are people who don't have wealth. And that's what I think it goes to maintaining. I think that being able to maintain wealth in a way that's dignified in practice, it points to our relationship with maintaining wealth and not being dualistic or ashamed of any wealth that we might have. So one more quote here from the Buddha. He said that a lay person has attained wealth through right effort, skill, and just means. He or she should take actions to protect it from the keen, thieves, fire, water, and unfriendly relatives. So a lay person who has obtained wealth through right effort, skill, and just means, he or she should take actions to protect it from the king, thieves, fire, water, and unfriendly relatives. He's talking to lay people. This is what he's saying. So one, assuming that you break through some of those barriers about the right to actually obtain wealth through righteous means, through the precepts, you know, fair dealing and whatnot, you obtain this wealth, then you are also obliged to protect it and to take care that it's not sort of squandered, which is kind of strange. That in the West, we actually have to begin to think about things like this as a way to practice. Us being such a wealthy country, such a wealthy culture, and yet we treat the Dhamma and our practice like we should not be. So the first thing he says in that quote is that we should take steps to protect it. And I want to talk a little bit about protecting wealth. You're protecting it from thieves and the king. So no overpaying your taxes. You don't want the king to come trying to get your stuff. I think there's a level of being honest in how you get it so that you don't get it confiscated by the government. Fire, water, and unfriendly relatives. And there's a sense that if you are protecting your wealth in that capacity, that you have a degree of respect for the wealth that you've earned. That it's not just randomly earned things. You almost have to, I tried this all week. I walked around my apartment and I looked at the things that I would protect from, like if there was a fire in my house, I asked myself, what would I want to grab first and run out of the house with? And mostly it was on the altar. But there's a way in which I could begin to see some things I just don't care about in my house. I don't care whether they're there or not, but some things I care about. So in this idea of beginning to think about maintaining wealth, there's a way in which we need to pay attention to what we are spending our money on. And if we're just consuming, just spending our money on things to have things in this kind of impulsive way, that is not of the protection of our wealth. So there's a need to actually pay attention to the money that you acquire and not just kind of squander it. There's this other part that he says that I think goes along with this is thinking about who you're spending your time with. So in the first kind of quote, that you are living this dignified life with friends and family and teachers, that there's a way that we can spend our lives with people that can bring our energies down or bring our energies up, that can create energy, and that energy can get translated in how we spend money. You know, I think I was telling people on Thursday, I know Monica Woods is a friend of mine. She wrote that book. She edited, I guess. She was close to the people who wrote the book, Your Money or Your Life. And in that book, if you haven't read it, it's an older book, older, you know, like a 1970, 1980s read. But it's about learning to see money as the energy in which your values come through. And I think that is so beautiful. I think that's what Buddha's pointing to when he's talking about how we maintain and acquire money. But it's really in the maintaining it. Has to do with whether or not you are maintaining your money in relation to your values, or whether or not you are maintaining your money in relation to the thinking mind, grasping mind, greed, aversion, and delusion. I'd like to read a poem from that a friend of mine gave me, this book of African American poems, and so I'd like to read. I'm going to read a couple of them here, but this is the first one. It has to do with the energy around your money. around wealth. I don't want to say money, but around wealth, the sense of whether you think you have enough in the world or whether you think there's some strong lacking of something in your life. It's by Lucille Clifton. It's untitled. This is what the poem says. In the inner city, or like we call it, home, we think a lot about uptown and the silent nights and the houses straight as dead men and the pastel lights. And we hang on to our no place, happy to be alive and in the inner city, or like we call it, home. So what I think this points to is, if you were to think about the inner city she's talking about, you might look there and think, oh, they don't have much there. They don't have much, not like the suburbs where the houses are all straight and everything is all good. But what she's really saying is that the quality of life around them, even in their own what we would consider unfortunate, is different because they call it home, because there's a felt sense of togetherness there regardless. And in some respects, when we're practicing with wealth, we are practicing with places of where we feel together, where we feel connected and having a sense of being being alive, friendly. And a lot of that is also pointed to who we're hanging out with, the people that we spend our time with, and whether or not those people that we spend our time with, even, you know, on Zoom now, but still, are we spending time with people who are giving us a sense of abundance, or are we spending our time with people who are creating a sense of lacking? There's not enough. There's scarcity. There's not enough. So the third thing that the Buddha noted is that there's a sutta where the Buddha says that you spend your money according to your finances. He said, a wise lay person knows the amount of money he or she's, that knows the amount of his or her income expenses. And with that knowledge, he or she calculates thus. My income does not exceed my expenses, nor do my expenses make up too meager a portion of my total income. Oh, I like that. I don't think I even noticed that part. So let me read it again, just for my own edification. Let's see. My income does not exceed my expenses, nor do my expenses make up too meager a portion of my total income. An experienced user of a scale, equal weights hanging on the ends of, knows, an experienced user of a scale knows, if I put this or that weight on this tray, the other tray will rise or fall at this level. Similarly, a householder must know how to balance the amount of his or her expenses. Yeah, I just think that there's a way in which the Buddha, in relation to householders, there's an evenness about this. I kind of like almost noticing now that I've always thought of that saying only on the side of don't overspend what you make. And that rang true to me when I became a teacher. I told myself I was going to live within the dana I received and not try to get more dana than I received so I could live a certain way. So my life was going to change from trying to get a certain amount of money in order to live within that means, but rather to live within the means of the donor I got. What I didn't notice until just now is the equal side of that is not to live our lives in such a way that we undermine what we make. There's a greed to that. There's a selfishness in that that's difficult to bear. It's not to say don't save, but there's a way in which, remember I told you last week my sister was, she was the one that lived, she had lots of money in the bank, but she lived very poorly, and I had no money in the bank. I didn't have no money at all because I spent it all. But I think that is what he's pointing to, both of those extremes. The extreme of living poorly because you will not spend or you're living meagerly. Your expenses are meager compared to what you make. Or on the converse, I am blowing everything because I'm living way outside of my means. Another poem to kind of keep us going. So first it's like, take steps to protect your wealth. Check who you're actually spending time with, because that's going to have something to do with your energy around money. Spend your money according to the amount of money you get or to your finances. And then this next one is, I wanted to read this in terms of spending time in relation with your money. It's another Lucille Clifton poem. I like this one. It's called Good Times. It says, my daddy has paid the rent and the insurance man is gone. And the lights is back on and my Uncle Bud has hit for $1 straight. And they is good times. Good times, good times. My mama has made bread and grandpa has come and everyone is drunk and dancing in the kitchen and singing in the kitchen. Oh, these is good times. Good times, good times. Oh, children, think about the good times. I love that poem. The reason why I love that poem is it's sort of like the good times. I think this is what I don't know if you can sense it, but when I read this poem, I get the sense that you have somehow balanced the money out a little bit here. We got the lights back on. I don't know if you guys have ever experienced what it's like to have the lights turned off, but I know what it's like to have the lights turned off. And then when you get the monies together to get the lights back on, and it's like your bills are paid, the lights are back on, and there's a sense of happiness that exists in that very moment right there. Not, I'm going to be secure from now on, but for this very moment, there is this joy and happiness that comes. And so in a way, this is what I think the Buddha is pointing to. We can get caught in this next step here. We can get caught in protecting our wealth in a way that goes beyond just protecting our wealth from government, thieves, and unfriendly relatives. So the next kind of step is we take steps for self-protection. So the way that the Buddha, you know, that one thing where your debts are, you know, he was, he used five examples of what would be happiness from the hindrances. And one of them was that your debts are paid. And one of them is you're on a road where it's unsafe and you finally make it home and your money and your property and everything is safe. These are examples of him, of Buddha, to me, being fully aware of the need to protect wealth. But at the same time, we can get trapped in our need to protect the wealth itself rather than paying attention to the need for the security that the wealth can bring. And so I thought about this poem when I got to these steps of around self-protection. Having a need to protect ourselves, wealth, abundance of friends, abundance of money, abundance of joy, abundance itself brings with it a level of protection. But that abundance is not protecting, we're not trying to protect the future relationship of that. We're trying to protect the immediate moment now. That's what I'm hoping I can point to, that you can see that are, if you're not feeling a sense of protection with all of the things you're doing to protect the wealth and your abundance around you, then somehow or another, you are not actually, you're not actually giving yourself a sense of security and protection. You are holding on to something more in the level of greed. I'm trying to think if I can think of a way to try to explain it. And so I'm going to go to the other few here and then maybe come back to it so I won't run out of time. But what I think this poem is pointing to is we take care of what it is that we need to take care of. We protect our money from being taken. But the whole point of that is to enjoy life in the moment and not live under a wedge of trying to protect some life we're going to have in the future or ensure some life that we're going to have in the future. These things that I'm giving you come out of a book called The Buddha's Teaching on Prosperity. It's from a Bhikkhu Rahula that I talked about yesterday. But the next thing he talks about is the Buddha's views around taking next necessary steps at the right time. So if you think about it, Buddha, from my perspective, Buddha was serious about time. Timeliness, timeliness, timeliness. You can see it in the precepts, like right speech is all about speaking in a timely way and paying attention to when you're speaking. He talks about it in the hindrances, about watching your energy for sloth and torpor or restlessness. He talks about it in the precepts around heedlessness and being careful about just getting careless and not paying attention to what you're doing in mindfulness. And the four foundations is all about being in the present moment. There's something about practice in relation to timeliness. And when we're talking about wealth, it is paying attention to the Bhikkhu Rahula was pointing to is not procrastinating, not being lazy, that you're actually paying attention into, it's like right effort in relation to your gaining money and wealth and power. But for me, I think it points to this idea that time is money, money is time, is not a delusion. Money is time and time is money, but it's more in relation to having a healthy respect for the cost that we spend in our lives around, how do I say this? I guess I'll say it like this. Maybe it's because I'm older now. And it seems like the older you get, the more you realize the little time you have left, the more realistic time actually becomes as a value. And so the more you pay attention to money, but the money that we could pay attention to is making sure I have enough money to stay in retirement, and how am I going to be able to afford things? And that can get very, very, very convoluted and complicated. And at the same time, there's a way that we can miss out on enjoying life for our futuristic thinking about money. But everything about our practice centers around this practicing in time right now. And so there's a way in which I think what the Buddha was pointing to around this timelessness is about being in the present moment with where you're at, almost the way Lucille Clifton is pointing to good times, actually enjoying life now at whatever level of wealth you're at, and not always leaving this idea of enjoyment of life to some time in the future. The last few things that... this is it. This is what I wanted to share. This is a poem or a quote, really, by Bayo. I think this is Akamo Lafi. I can't pronounce it. I think it's Akomo Lafi. That's what I think it is. Akomo Lafi. And this is what they say. The times are urgent. Let us slow down. A different urgency is called for in these moments. So moments about talking about wealth, understanding, trying to practice with your relationship with wealth. Given a pandemic, economy falling apart, the times are urgent. Let us slow down. A different urgency is called for in these moments. A broadening of the spectrum of action. A different kind of accountability. One which knows that love is not a bridge, love is a hyphen. So different questions are alive right now. It is time for a sacred activism for asking new questions, for slowing down, for applying the wisdom and clarity of a cultivated heart mind. Fearless compassion, the fearlessness of compassion leads us directly into conflict and suffering of life. Fearless compassion recognizes the inevitable suffering of life and our need to face the suffering in order to learn. Sometimes only the fire of suffering itself and the consequences of our actions can bring us deeper understanding, to feel kindness for all beings and to liberation. The reason why I wanted to talk about that in relation to time is because I think that we can get so caught up in our future thinking when we think about maintaining wealth. We can get so caught up in our future thinking about what we want the money to be for, or how we want to live, or what we want, what things we need to have around us, that we begin more related to the timeliness of getting. Having, holding. But we don't pay attention to the suffering and the difficulty that comes in that quality of getting, having, holding. And what I think the Buddha was pointing to is that if you put your attention here in the present moment, in the nowness, then you're going to start feeling the suffering that comes with that quality of how we are acquiring and maintaining and holding wealth, whether or not it's actually serving us as practitioners. So the last grouping that he talks about is moderation in romantic relationships, which is kind of weird, but the Buddha actually said it's better to have one partner than multiple partners, because multiple partners end up causing us to scatter all our money, use up all our money. We can see that. Yes, I agree with that. The more partners you have, the more you're going to start losing all your monies. Refrain from addictions, gambling, and entertainment. And to me, all of that is pointing to there is a way in which we, as lay practitioners, we enjoy life through the sense doors. We acquire wealth and get wealth as a part of our lives, and we need to acquire wealth, and we need to feel into a sense of abundance and not scarcity. And then when we acquire this wealth, we need to maintain it, and we need to protect it, and we need to keep it as a part of us so that we have it in order to live life and enjoy life. But there is a way that we can get caught in the spending of that money through addictions, partners, entertainment, gambling. All of that to me is pointing to the overindulgence of our whatever wealth or whatever means we acquire. We can get trapped in the overindulgence of that pleasure. That there is the underindulgence of that pleasure by, like my sister, who lives very miserly. And then there is the overindulgence, like me, very, very free and wild. And we somehow, as practitioners, want to begin to pay attention to that and notice when we're living too far on one side. I got one more quote to read here. This quote is by James Baldwin. I'm probably going to have to explain why I'm saying this quote, because it may not, when I first read it, it may not seem like these quotes are necessarily connected to wealth. But I guess the reason why I want to read these quotes is because there's something about being Black in America that's so intertwined with suffering that our ability to stay present with whatever's happening is a great lesson in how to practice as a lay practitioner. There's something about that that helps us all learn to practice as lay practitioners. And James Baldwin was not even Buddhist, not that I can tell. But this quote, you may have heard it from Dora, because she uses it all the time, and I just grabbed it from her when I thought about what I was going to say here. It sounds exactly what Buddha would have been saying to me. So this is what James Baldwin says. Life is tragic simply because the earth turns and the sun rises and sets And one day, for each of us, the sun will go down for the last time. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives. We'll imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations, in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have. It seems to me that one ought to rejoice in the fact of death, ought to decide indeed to earn one's death by confronting with passion the conundrum of life. One is responsible to life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we shall return. One must negotiate this passage as nobly as possible for the sake of those who are coming after us. It is the responsibility of free men and women and non-gendered people to trust and to celebrate what is constant. Birth, struggle, and death are constant. And so is love, though we may not always think so. And if I add, and so is wealth, though we may not always think so. And to apprehend the nature of change, to be able and willing to change. I speak of change not on the surface, but in the depths. Change in the sense of renewal. But renewal becomes impossible if one supposes things to be constant. They are not. Safety, for example, or money or power. One clings to them by which one can only be betrayed, and the entire hope, the entire possibility of freedom disappears. Mr. Baldwin, what I really think he's trying to say is really pointed to our concept of wealth. Because in the final kind of end of the whole thing, we are all going to die. And we are not taking anything with us. And somehow or another, wealth becomes this thing that sets an identity of who we are, that determines what we should do, what we can do, what we can't do. There's all these cultural, family, friend kind of norms that we live in around wealth, around what constitutes abundance, about what's a good life, do I have enough, is it fair, how much do I give, I don't know, I can't tell you how many times when the Donna talk comes, the flood of questions about what to do about Donna. And everybody will say, give whatever you want. You know, however you want to give is your business. You know, Donna's yours. And even with that, give whatever you want. There is this unbelievable flood. How much do I give? Well, is there a certain amount? Well, what do most people give? I mean, it's just the questions about it. Because we have such a difficulty around the idea of wealth. I think what James Baldwin's trying to say, or at least the way I've picked up on it, is it's all about death. We kind of missed it here. It's all about death. We're all going to die at some point anyway. So what the Buddha, I think, was pointing to is if you're going to live a lay life as a lay practitioner, then you can enjoy the pleasures of being a lay practitioner, which includes wealth, so long as you are willing to look at, practice with, and stay with the difficulties that also come with wealth. And what that means is some of us are going to have more than others. And we are going to feel the twinge and the pain of that difficulty of seeing someone who has less than me. Not less fortunate, just less than me. We are, all of us, going to have to deal with the reality that the economy could tank and I may not have no money. So then what would I do? That is a natural part of life. All of us have to deal with the fact that sometimes we're going to have enough money and sometimes we're not. Sometimes our sense of wealth is not going to come from money. It's going to come from our friends who are helping us out, inspiring us, cheering us up. You can do it. Sometimes we may have plenty of money, but we're being dragged down by people and we're miserable. The idea that I think the Buddha was pointing to when we start thinking about wealth is not so much about how much money we have, but how much are we enjoying life regardless of our money. And if we're not enjoying life, then as a practitioner, we're missing something. Because the monastic core was considered the happy ones. So why are the lay practitioners not happy? Right? We should be happy. Yeah, there should be some degree of happiness with this. So I want to leave us with my quote again from Mr. Relke. Be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves. Like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue, do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So we'll sit a moment here. Okay, let's see if we have any questions about this or comments. You don't even actually have to have questions. You can just have comments. Oh, just realized I forgot to ask people to put their comments or where they're from in there in the chat. That's okay. I'll remember next time, hopefully. You might have to use your raised hand. I see you. Is this Maylis? You should be able to. Oh, yeah, you can. Okay, go ahead.
I wanted to get your recommendation on how you navigate or how you would recommend navigating wealth and how you earn and work hard for it versus privilege. So acknowledging privilege, too, as it relates to wealth.
Well, this is what I'm trying to point to. If you're looking at privilege as let me just check. Are you talking about privilege like white privilege? like the way we talk about it now? Or are you talking about privilege because you come from a lot of money?
I think privilege, just in not necessarily coming from a lot of money or race, but just in maybe a combination of things that maybe make it easier for you to be successful in terms of where you were born. Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah, more like the way we talk about it now in this social activist kind of way that we talk about privilege. And this is the point I'm making, is that much of us don't know our privileges because we don't pay attention to the people who have what my friend was saying, less fortunate. So I don't know the privilege of being an English speaker unless I go around or pay attention to the people who don't speak English. I don't know the privilege of being an educated person unless I be around people who aren't educated, or I get to know what it's like not to be educated and how limiting it is. So from my point of view, that is exactly what you have to do as a practitioner, is to begin to notice your privileges, and you'll notice it by noticing the tensions where you don't pay attention to other people in the world. That's the best way I have found to notice privilege. I don't think you'll notice it on your own. I don't think I ever would have noticed the privilege of being an educated person until I started paying attention to people who were uneducated and how limiting life is if you're not educated.
Yeah, I think the question I have too is more so like, once you acknowledge those privileges, not giving into the suffering, like still acknowledging and appreciating your wealth, but not also like being empathetic too without beating, like feeling guilt. Does that make sense?
Yes. You don't have to feel guilt about it. You can, guilt comes from, I believe, not fully being intimate with the fact that you have a privilege. That's what I'm trying to say. When you're fully aware of something as a privilege, if you're practicing with wealth, then you're going to automatically have the generosity and the paramis to support you in supporting other people. So it's like, I guess the best way to say it is, if you don't pay attention to your privileges, then you won't feel the pain of other people's not having. And that pain is not going to lead you into guilt. What leads you into guilt is the not paying attention. When you start paying attention to other people's difficulties, what it's going to lead you to as a practitioner is actually being of help, generosity, and the paramis. But that's what I'm trying to say. The difficulty we often have is that, I guess I'm going to say it like this. Reverend Angel one time, I don't know if you guys listened to the election challenge that 10% Happier did, but 10% Happier did this election challenge, and they had Reverend Angel as the compassion person. So now sometimes when we talk about compassion, we talk about compassion like, you know, it's loving, like being compassionate to puppies and kittens. And it's a very sweet kind of lovey kind of way. But Reverend Angel is not like that. So when she talked about compassion, she was talking about it more like having a warrior spirit. Like, don't come in here crying because things are bad for me. If you're going to come in here with me, then you got to come in here with a little bit more spirit about it. And the only way you can do that is if you've looked into the mirror of your own suffering. That's what I'm trying to say. So mostly, if we begin to look at what we have against the backdrop of what other people don't have, it is painful. I got an example that maybe we'll make this a little bit clearer. because it's hard to talk about privilege. And this might make it a lot clearer. This is a political example, so I don't want to be offensive, but it's a political example. You know how when we saw the storming of the Capitol, and you're asking yourself, where the hell are all the cops? Where's the nine deep rows of police officers that we usually see when we see some kind of Black Lives Matter protest, right? And the pain that you felt about something's wrong here, that right there, it does not require you to fix the wrong, but it does help you feel the unfairness of it. It's where you begin to see something is amiss here. It's where you begin to see privilege. And when you can see privilege, you will begin to automatically notice it more and more in your everyday life. It's not the reason why privilege has gotten so out of hand is because we rarely have felt it like we have felt it over the last year or so. And it has been very clear over the last year or so. That's what it is that we're feeling. That's why it's so much suffering, is because we're actually seeing privilege in a way that we didn't see it before. And maybe it's just because of the pandemic and we're all stuck at home. We're like looking at TV and we can see these things more clearly now. I don't know what it is, but mostly what I think people see is their privilege. And so that pain is not, if you fall into guilt about the pain, it doesn't work, because then you're going to just tuck yourself back into the privilege and not look. I just can't watch all that violence. I can't watch that stuff on TV. It's too upsetting. But if you stay with the difficulty of it, then you can begin to actually step up and do things, mainly because you will hear things and you will know the privilege. And it can change an entire generation. So as difficult as it is to deal with things like privilege, the facing the pain of it is what's going to get us through, not somehow or another getting caught up in the guilt of it. Because there's no point in having the guilt of it. The point is more that it won't stay like this if you get out of the guilt and just begin to, you know, when an opportunity presents itself, then you'll do something about it. But it doesn't mean you have to go out there and start, you know, fighting all the alt-right people just to, because you're mad about privilege. It just means that if you notice in your job that things are not righteous, then you'll feel that twinge in the gut. You'll feel it as a practitioner, and to begin to just speak up about it. And I think over time it'll change. Cara.
Hi, thank you again for having me. I know I'm new here, and so I appreciate
this. Oh, you're great.
Thank you. I didn't realize how much this talk would resonate with me. But it really, really did. And there's something coming up for me that I would love some advice from the Dhamma with, which is I'm having a lot of trouble on the protection part, protecting the wealth. I'm in a very particular situation where I am very clearly being taken advantage of by somebody I hired as a contractor who is a friend. And I've never actually been in this situation, though I know it's really common that you hire a friend and it's a bad idea. But I am having so much trouble defending and protecting what's mine. And I'm finding that it's just easier to give away the money, even though the money's running out. Mm-hmm. And also what you talked about, the energy, like it's just spilling out. It feels horrible. And I'm a very like direct, I'm not conflict avoidant. I don't think of myself that way. But I, in this situation, I'm just like, the fastest way to end it is just to keep spending money. And I want to end it, but I need to protect myself, and it's just been really painful, and I am really caught in this conflict. So any advice around that?
So from the Dhamma's perspective, the Dhamma is not really about, I couldn't tell you one way or the other what to do about a situation like that. I can't tell you, oh, do it like this, and then that's going to fix. Because Dhamma really isn't about fixing anything. What Dhamma is designed to do is exactly what has happened to you. It is designed to get you to pay attention to the place where you are feeling the greatest amount of pain and suffering. Once you come to that understanding, this is painful here, then you can fully work to alleviate the pain. The reason why we have so much difficulty is because we try to avoid the pain that you are coming face to face with. And instead, we try to pay it all off to get rid of it so I don't have to come face to face with the pain. But this, what the Dhamma's job is not to fix or tell you what to do, but to give you a clear sense there is suffering here. So the idea is somehow or another, the release from that suffering is going to come from craving. It's going to come from letting go of some kind of clinging or craving. So whatever you're clinging or craving to, it could be clinging or craving to this guy finally ending it. It could be clinging or craving to it getting done within the way I wanted it to get done. I have no idea what that clinging is. But that's what the Dhamma points towards letting go. So what you're feeling, where you're at, is exactly what the Dhamma is supposed to do. Push us, take us over into that upset place that says, surely it can't be this. It's like, nope. This is exactly why we're talking about wealth, why we're talking about it like this, because this is what we are all trying to look at. Not just you. You just happen to see it in relation to getting this project done. But we all have places where we're trying our best not to see the difficulties and the tensions, and it's around wealth, money, holding on to it, acquiring, do I have enough? I don't feel like I have enough, all of that. Okay?
That's really helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Suzanne? Guess you'll be last.
Okay, I'll be fast.
Oh, no, it's okay. Okay. I'll just try not to say so much.
I just need to tell you, Tawiri, that every single string that you strung together was like completely in the zone. The Baldwin, the death with the anti-racist stuff, with the abundance, it all was so like, I think it's because I love talking about things that no one likes to talk about.
Oh, so
like the wealth and I spent most of my 20s and 30s. My life shouldn't be about money, so it ended up just being about scarcity, which was funny because I used to think there was something other than scarcity and abundance. And I was sitting here tonight, I was like, oh, no, there's scarcity or abundance. It's not neutral. I actually thought like, oh, well, there's that middle place where money doesn't matter. There's scarcity and abundance. There's one or the other. There's like being mindful of that wealth piece that you're talking about, or there's running from it or squirming around it or whatever. So I that hit me tonight. And it's it just was, it never hit me before.
Well, there's one thing I can toss in here.
Yeah.
Suzanne, that, well, you could say the middle ground that the Buddha was trying to point us to, I think, sometimes, is to know when you're in abundance and to know when you're in scarcity.
Yes.
Because if we operate out of scarcity, we can cause a lot of harm. And so we need to know that we're operating out of scarcity.
Yeah.
That understanding of it, or operating out of abundance.
Yeah, and the knowledge of such. The knowledge of, oh, I'm here. Yes, that knowledge piece, like, hit me today. Like, it's not just some autopilot. Like, that knowing and the yeah. intentionality and, like, and anyway, and I could go on. I could go on, but, and I've always lived, like, the highest living, I heard this somewhere, is living into inquiry and living into questions, and that people with too many answers, giving people with lots of questions, and that's like paradise for me. So thank you.
You're welcome. Just know that when you're in the knowing that I'm living in scarcity, or in the knowing that I'm living in abundance, that would be the neutral zone. Because you're not identified with whatever it is that you know.
Oh.
We're in scarcity. When we're in scarcity, we're identified with it and we're acting out of that scarcity. Or if we are in abundance, we can be acting out of that, and people can be overly giving, or they can be, you know, you can get caught in... I think this is where privilege is, like, I got so much and lucky me and all of that. You're identified with what you have. But when you are in awareness, you're aware of abundance, you're aware of scarcity, you're aware of these places, but you're not identified with it. Because it's not really you anyway. It's energy, it's energetic.
Yeah.
It's not really you.
Yeah, so that's even... That's
what we're practicing with.
That's even deeper than what I thought it was.
So that, okay. I think that's where your neutral zone is.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you.
All right, you guys. So next week, we are going to have a discussion on this. And I did a little exercise with Capitol Hills Group, and I loved it. I didn't want to do it today, so I'm going to do it next week. And I think it was a great way to open up some conversations around wealth and coming to terms with our sense of scarcity and abundance. So we'll try it next week. All right. We don't have any announcements on we would normally not have announcements on. This would be a discussion night, but it's fine. I will just see us all next week. Do we have anything else? Are we good? All right. Good. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you so much.